Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. While there are some signs that violence against women is somewhat on the decline, it's still a major problem. One in four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime. Tens of thousands of women are raped or victims of other sexual violence every year. That's one of the reasons Congress passed and President Obama recently signed reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. It updates and expands the original 1994 Act. What has changed, and what does that mean for women in our area? I'm Don Marsh. That's what we're talking about on today's program. Joining me in studio are Michelle Schiller-Baker, Executive Director of St. Martha's Hall. Susan Kidder, Executive Director of Safe Connections. Both organizations serve women who have been victims of violence. Also with us is Lisa Jones, Director of the Victim Service Division in the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
This is certainly a timely subject. I understand that the Senate is holding hearings today on women in the military who have been victims of violence. So that and the passage of or the reauthorization of the act certainly make it a timely subject. Susan, let me begin with you. Very basically, what changes does this reauthorized version make in the original?
Well, the original was enacted back in 1994, actually brought forward by then-Senator Joe Biden, and it lapsed in 2011. And then during 2012, there were attempts after attempts after attempts to get it passed again and reenacted. The principal changes from the original Violence Against Women Act to today's Violence Against Women Act includes provisions for protections for those who identify as lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and gay, and those who are immigrants and those who are Native Americans.
So it's not a sweeping change in one sense, and yet it is in another because it includes a lot more people, obviously.
Exactly. It enumerates those groups.
Yeah, right. Well, why did it take so long, do you think, Michelle, for this to be reauthorized? It lapsed in 2011, I think.
Right. Well, I think you'd have to look at just historically the whole issue of violence against women and how long it's been with us on the face of the earth. There's a systemic oppression of women still, globally and in this country. So whenever you're talking about changing systems, something that's systemic, it takes a very long time. And particularly this issue with violence against women, because those of us who are here today believe it happens because of power and control and oppression, and not because of mental illness or drugs or anger management issues. So whenever you're talking about changing the balance of power when it comes to violence, you're going to have a lot of backlash that people don't want to admit that it's actually happening, especially violence against women, because historically, again, it's been something that's been very private and kept secret, usually between in a family or couples. And when these kinds of things come to the forefront, it's very difficult for any society to begin to grasp just how endemic it is among us.
It's also been my impression that there was a lot of resistance in Congress to the changes that Susan just mentioned with regard to the LGBT community and also the Indian lands issue.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, that's, you know, if you're talking about oppression of women and you look at the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people in our society, that type of backlash is going to be even stronger.
Right. And domestic violence occurs in same-sex relationships at roughly the same rate as in opposite sex or heterosexual couples or relationships. So it's because individuals who identify as LGBT, they lack the recognition and there are far fewer resources for that community. And then with Native American women, I mean, statistics show us that Native American women are victims of domestic and sexual violence 3.5 times the national average. So it's a huge issue there. One in three Native American women are raped in their lifetime. And then obviously with the undocumented immigrants, I mean, they understandably fear interfacing with law enforcement. So having these provisions in VAWA are critical, vital for these groups and for all women.
VAWA being the acronym for the Violence Against Women's Act. I'm sure we'll hear that more on this program, but just to make sure that people know. Lisa, go ahead.
Well, I also think, Don, getting back to your initial question, I think part of it also has to do with the climate in Washington, D.C., especially mm-hmm. in the last several years. I mean, it's no news to anybody, you know, listening or here today that there's dramatic polarization among the Democrats, the Republicans. And I think that you take an issue like VAWA that should have sailed easily through Congress, and I think you get some of the dynamics of what's going on right now in Washington, D.C., that caused a great deal of the controversy, especially around the gay and lesbian issue. It's a hot topic for a lot of people within the party.
Yeah, that's one of those social issues that is the hot button.
Absolutely.
And people
correct.
Tend to really get distracted by that. Lisa, is there anything that would affect your job with regard to law enforcement and prosecution in this new reauthorized act?
Well, absolutely. I think it continues something that has been a large part of the movement in being able to utilize the VAWA funds for specific training. And we've seen that over the years that VAWA has been involved. There's been specific training for police officers, judges, certainly prosecuting attorneys. Different programs within the court system have been set up that are directly a result of being able to access VAWA money. That has certainly made it easier for women to feel safer in coming forward. You know, there have absolutely been improvements in the last 10 and 15 years for women who have been victims of violence, domestic and sexual violence, in the court system. Do we need to make some continued steps? Absolutely, no doubt about it. But any kind of social change movement takes time. And I think the renewal of funding will provide more adequate and better training for not just judges, police officers, and prosecutors specific to sexual violence against women and domestic violence.
How far has law enforcement come over the years in understanding the issues? It wasn't too long ago, and I've done some work in this area, where an officer who would be the first responder to mm-hmm. a case of domestic abuse or violence perhaps would walk in and almost automatically side with the man in the mm-hmm. case. Has that changed dramatically?
It has. Do we still see cases of bias mm-hmm. and prejudice? Absolutely. But there's been a concerted effort on the part of law enforcement to specifically train officers around the dynamics of domestic violence and sexual assault. We've seen victim or evidence-based prosecution because we know that many women are fearful of the system and mistrustful of the system, so they are less likely to want to participate in prosecution. So officers are specifically trained on how to investigate and document these cases so that in the event that a woman chooses at some point to not want to testify or is reluctant to testify, that we have corroborating evidence that can support her statements. And that's a direct result of the training and the funding that was available through VAWA.
Susan, let me turn back to you with regard to what's going on in our area. How severe a problem is this problem in our region?
Well, in our region is a microcosm of, you know, the United States. We as organizations serve thousands upon thousands of women and kids who are victims of domestic and sexual violence. So the rate is prevalent. The occurrence is prevalent, and the organizations that are in St. Louis are working hard every single day to not only serve those who are victims, but also to do a lot of prevention work, and make sure that we have the systems in place for teaching our kids about healthy relationships and actually involving boys and men in the work, because boys and men are allies or can be allies, need to understand their role as champions, leaders of their peers in being role models for healthy masculinity. So our approach, so the prevalence is high. And our unified approach in the St. Louis region is to address these issues through prevention, crisis intervention, and counseling and support groups and residential services.
Michelle, let me turn to you with this on the prevention side of things. What are the kinds of things that can be done to prevent it?
Well, Susan went straight to the point on that one. Education, because again, as I said a little earlier, we firmly believe that this is not a mental health issue, that this is a social political issue. So you need to begin to change the way people view violence against women, that it's no longer acceptable. It's not just something you put up with. I mean, I remember growing up, a grandparent, my grandmother, saying to me, you know, Michelle, you're just going to have to realize that there's a lot that you're going to have to put up with someday when you get married. That's just the way it is. So we have to change that. So prevention in our minds is education.
So it starts very early then.
It has to start very early. It has to start the minute that child gets born into this world, that you begin to talk to little boys about these issues and little girls about these issues, you know, so that it's not separated apart from them. It has to start early to change that mindset.
That is a long-range proposition.
That is though, a very long-range proposition.
What about the woman who is in a relationship now where she might feel threatened? I mean, is there a way to get at the prevention mode for her?
Well, if she's already being threatened, prevention is gone because it's already happened. So now we're talking intervention. So we want to get the word out to women who are in these relationships, what's a safe way to leave. What's her support system set up? You know, sometimes with the very best of intentions, people give women who are in these relationships very poor advice on the safe way to leave. So we would always say, call a battered women's organization. Call a victim unit with your local prosecuting attorney's office. There are people there that will help you figure out how do you safely leave this relationship. I mean, Don, I mean, you said that you've been seeing this for years in your work in the media. A woman's risk of dying rises 75% once she leaves. So, you know, battered women do leave, but they know very clearly that it could cost them their lives. So what we want to do is set it up so that she can do so in a very as safe as possible. Nothing's a guarantee, but we'll do our best.
Lisa, a lot of them don't leave. Why?
Well, to add on to what Michelle said, you know, there is a certain risk, you know, for many of our cases, we do see an increased risk of the manipulative, coercive, and violent behavior when a woman does try and leave. You know, on top of that, for certain relationships, you know, none of us meet someone and falls in love thinking, oh, well, this will last 3 or 4 years, and then probably I'll have to divorce or leave. So there's certainly a cultural issue that comes up that we meet someone, we fall in love with them. If we marry them, you know, people are raised in certain religious upbringings where, you know, for better or for worse. And I think that speaks to some of the work that we do that Michelle touched on and Susan about the way in which we socialize men and women in this country, the choices that we make. And I think we need to make this point as well repeatedly. Violence is a choice that people make in a relationship. Coercion is a choice that people make. These abusive behaviors are choices, so no one forces them to make them, but it's a way in which we have power and control over our partners. And so I think there are a myriad of reasons why people stay. Sometimes it's economic reasons. You know, if I'm a mother with 3 children and I haven't worked outside of the home, I'm frightened. Where do I go? How do I support my family? So there's institutional reasons why women stay, educational reasons, social reasons. There are just a myriad of reasons why women stay.
And we asked the question, why does she stay?
Correct.
There are lots of different answers to that. And the real spotlight question is, why doesn't he stop being violent?
Absolutely.
Why doesn't he stop being the abuser?
Yeah. I have to take a break. Let's do that now. We're talking about domestic violence and sexual abuse against women. We're talking about it in the context of the recently reauthorized Violence Against Women Act. And my guests in studio are Michelle Schiller-Baker, Executive Director of Martha's Hall. Susan Kidder is Executive Director of Safe Connections. Also with us in studio is Lisa Jones, Director of the Victim Service Division in the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. Back to continue our conversation, and we certainly want to bring you into it. Have you dealt with or are you dealing with abuse or violence? We'd very much like to hear from you. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, and you can also reach us through Facebook. Back with our guests in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation in light of the recent reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. We're talking about violence and abuse of women. In studio here with me is Michelle Schiller-Baker, Executive Director of Martha's Hall, Susan Kidder, Executive Director of Safe Connections, and Lisa Jones, Director of the Victim Service Division with the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. Susan, let me go back to you with regard to something I've always heard, and I assume it's still true, and that is that abusers often were abused themselves as children. I've also heard, I think, that often the abused were abused as children.
Yeah, that is so individualized. I mean, certainly. What we know is that those who are victims of abuse as children, particularly boys, are twice as likely to become abusers when they are adult male. And that gets back to the critical work that organizations do around prevention, working with our young boys, our young women. And really, in our case at Safe Connections, we provide prevention education and individual therapy and support groups for women, teen girls, and teen boys. And part of that is intervention and treatment for, you know, their experience as victims of abuse, but also to help change their trajectory, to help so recalibrate for them so that their experience as a young person as a victim of violence does not necessarily mean that they're going to grow up to be an abuser.
Lisa, what happens when they get to you?
Well, frequently, by the time they've gotten to us, there's already been an interaction with law enforcement. And so, you know, we see a variety of different victims. Some have left their abusers. Some are still currently in an abusive relationship. There's a large majority of people who certainly want some type of resolution and accountability for the batterer in their lives. And then there are also the group that just want the violence to end but don't necessarily want someone to go away to prison for the rest of their lives, you know, because perhaps they do have children in common. So that, again, that family dynamic is still very powerful in the lives of some of these women. So we get it across the full spectrum.
Sure. We're starting to get calls, but Michelle, I want to come back to you because the word children just came up again. Mm-hmm. And this is part of the story, too, because often children are involved. How do you deal with that?
Well, at the shelter, we have a program just for the children to work with them, support groups and individual works to get them to hear from somebody for the first time, perhaps, that it wasn't their fault. They didn't cause it. They do not need to intervene in it. We want to teach them how to be safe in case they go back into that environment and that this is certainly not normal. They need to hear that. And then personally, you know, how you deal with it, you know, we all live in a world with children, so I am always talking to anybody that will listen to me about how do you raise your children without violence, without physical discipline, without violent toys, without videos that are violent, anything that pertains to play, but it makes violence part of it, that's not normal. So you deal with it in a lot of different ways. And I think all of us would say, anybody who is in what we call the battered women's movement, this is a lifetime commitment. You are on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And if there's a battered woman, there may also be a battered child.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. A lot of calls, not unexpectedly. We'll begin with Justin calling from St. Louis. Justin, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Wonderful topic as usual. Speaking straight to the point that your expert was just talking about, I work in a Sunday school. It's a multicultural church, and I've noticed in some cultures, and this is just one example, it's more acceptable to play violently, and even to the extent where it's not just boys hitting boys, it's actually boys hitting girls, girls hitting boys. Whereas when I grew up, even in play, it was a no-no. Boys don't hit girls. And so my question is specifically along that lines and in any other examples that you can think of off the top of your head, what are some appropriate things? Does that help or hinder the don't hit girls? Does that cause resentment, or does that actually help breed a culture of people who don't have violent tendencies? Is it just no violent play at all? Can you give some guidelines around that for people who work with children like myself?
Lisa.
Well, I was just going to say that I think in general, I encourage everyone to find nonviolent forms of expression between men and women, between, you know, boys. And I think that that really speaks to the way, again, in our culture, how we socialize men and women. And there is certainly a thing in not just in the United States, but all over the world, where masculinity is somehow tied to some kind of violence. That in order to be seen as masculine, I have to have a certain amount of bravado and I have to be brave. And somehow those words are tied with being physically aggressive and violent. And I think that there's a way that we need to strip that down for young men. It doesn't serve us any purpose to have these violent video games. Certainly the imagery and music of men and women, particularly and I don't want to pick on this particular genre, but we certainly see it very prevalent within hip-hop music videos, where so much of masculinity is tied to violent imagery. And I think that that starts when kids are little, and that we need to find ways that it's not appropriate to hit girls. It's not appropriate for boys to hit boys. It's about a respectful way of treating human beings is the way I look at it. Michelle, Susan?
Yeah, I'm going to go with that, too. And yeah. For Justin, you know, just working with small children is to first let them know that it's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, you don't have to get all touchy-feely about it. It's just like, no, we don't do this here. And then starting to talk about that child, what was your intention? Why did you do that? Get that child to start thinking about, why was I violent? And what did I think I was going to get out of it? And how then, long-term, it's really going to come back to haunt them. I mean, children are incredibly bright, and they pick up on those pieces, and they connect those dots a lot faster than we think they do.
And sometimes children are the best teachers of parents and the best teachers for all of us. So if we get to the kids, just like Michelle said, and talk with them about, you know, respectful play and respectful relationships, then they embody that. And they then can be, in some cases, the role models for adults and others in their lives. And really, when you get the cultural component in there, it makes it even more challenging. Yet we have to have hope that there can be change.
What should the role of teachers be or school administrators be when they see something like this going on? I mean, this can be kind of touchy. This is a litigious society, and the fear that going to the parent might create some problems. What should the role be?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that there are a lot of schools, many of the public schools, you know, each of our organizations goes in and actually speaks to classes. There are health departments. Their health classes have a whole subsection on violence against women, domestic violence, violence within a family, child abuse. So they are touching on it. And I think most of the schools do have protocols in terms of how to address violent outbursts between kids. But, you know, what you said, Susan, is so true in the way that we just have to directly address it with children. We all remember years ago, you know, we're all old enough to remember, you know, the little boy pulling on our hair and our mother saying, oh, that's just the way that a sign that he likes you. Well, that may have been true, but there's also other ways that we can teach kids to communicate with one another in nonviolent ways. And I think that starts from the time, you know, they're toddlers.
Susan?
And one of the roots of violence or roots of power and control is misogyny. Mm-hmm. In its many forms, sometimes insidious, sometimes very obvious and direct. Becoming more gender neutral, for example, in language. Not expecting behaviors because that's how boys are or that's how girls are. Mm-hmm. Encouraging boys in particular to show their vulnerabilities, to not have to be so macho all of the time, and to then be able to treat women and girls as equals.
Let's take another call. Mm-hmm. I want to bring in Ron calling from Belleville. He has, I think he's looking for some advice that you ladies could give him. Go ahead, Ron.
Oh, hi, and thank you for taking my call. I really like the comment about children sometimes being the role model for adults. I know for me and my wife, that certainly has been true raising my kids. But what I wanted to talk about the most was how confusing and how hard it was when, as a young kid growing up in a household where there was violence, not on a regular basis, but not every day, but over a period of years, certainly several times, and it's so hard to see the two people that you love the most and look up to the most hurting each other, you know, and not only with words, but with, you know, physically as well. And we never talked about it, you know, outside of the family, and it was like a big secret and everything. But I always wanted to confront my father about it, and it was too scary. I just couldn't, you know. I was just a kid.
Ron, go ahead. Let's get some response from the ladies in the studio here. I'll start with you, Michelle. How do you confront an abuser?
Well, Ron, as a child, it would have been very, very difficult. Perhaps, you know, for other children in that same situation, when they're young like that, you might go to somebody outside the family. But, Ron, you're right. It breeds in secrecy. It breeds in fear. And fear is the base cause of that. You know, one person is fearful of that. They're not going to have control over the other. For you personally, I would really encourage you to seek support from somebody else, even now as an adult. And I think you are the living, breathing embodiment of how difficult this is. You carry it with you for a lifetime. Even once you get out of it, it's still there. So, Ron, first I would really encourage you to reach out to someone, get some support, and, you know, someday you may be able to confront your father on that. But don't do it in a vacuum. I think you owe that to yourself. You've survived a lot, and you're a good person for it.
Anybody want to add to that, Susan or Lisa?
I would just echo what Michelle said, is that also kudos to Ron for recognizing that and openly talking about the fact that he did grow up in a violent home. And one of the tell-alls that he also said is very consistent, is that the abusive behavior is not always 24/7. It is sometimes the inconsistency and the unpredictability of it that can cause some really long-range damage to especially children. You just never know where it's going to come from or when it's going to come from, and it actually makes young children live in a very hyper-vigilant environment, which, you know, the stress of that alone can cause chronic stress-related issues throughout their life.
You'll see a lot of children of battered women misdiagnosed with ADHD. And that's really just because they had to live to be hyper-vigilant, like Lisa was saying. So, you know, reach out and try to get that support you need.
And, Ron, know that you're not by yourself. As Michelle said, there are resources for you. And you are one of the 3.5 million kids in our country who witness domestic violence every single year. So good for you, Ron.
As a matter of fact, that can make it even more shocking, I suppose, when it happens sporadically and comes out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's
well, it never really comes out of nowhere. It comes out of a very well-defined space that person who's being abusive has set up. And when Ron was talking about these long-term, you know, spaces in between, that is all part of the manipulation. It's like, let them lull it into everything's great. Let there be a moment of peace, because then you lull people into that person who's going to be abused to thinking it's not so bad. There are these really wonderful 3 years in between the violence. That is really all part of the manipulation and how you coerce somebody. It's no different than what you do when you're a prisoner. Remember prisoners of war, where they would say, well, you know, they were, every once in a while they'd let us have mail from home. It wasn't so bad. So every once in a while you give them that nice little gift of peace, and then it lulls them into thinking things are going to be better.
I think that's called the Stockholm Syndrome, where ultimately you become attached to your captor, if you will. In this
Absolutely.
Case, it would be the abuser.
That's right.
Let's take another call, and Linda will join us from St. Louis. Linda, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. A lot of the emphasis is on the women because they are the victims and on the children. But what resources do we have to turn this around for the men who are already abusers? This is a cultural thing. This is sometimes lack of skill in knowing how to deal with other people and going for power because you don't have any other way to do this. But what kind of resources are there short of the court made you go to abuse class? What kind of resources are there for the abusing men?
You know, St. Louis is actually very fortunate in that we have a number of batterers intervention programs. that are not, and I want to say this again, not anger management classes, because people who are violent know how to manage their anger. But in a batterer's intervention program, the majority of them are a 26-week program that really speaks to some of the dynamics that both Michelle and Susan have talked to, that it is a pattern of behaviors where the intention is to have power and control over the people in your life. And batterer's intervention programs begin to address that issue with men, as well as address the issues of redefining masculinity and learning about how, as a culture, some of their behaviors were taught through certainly the families of origin, through the media, through Hollywood, images that they get through their social networks. And it's really about stripping that down and learning better nonviolent ways to communicate with everyone in your life, not just your direct partner, but every single person in your life. And so we're very fortunate in that we do have many programs in St. Louis that deal specifically with men.
Anything to add to that, Susan and Michelle?
One thing. The greatest resource out there for men who are abusive is themselves. This is a choice, and they have to decide, I no longer wish to live this way. It's not a fun way to live. So that's his greatest resource. And then once he comes to realize that, there will be people ready to help him.
Have to take another break. We're going to do that now. My guests in studio, as we continue to discuss the subject of domestic violence and sexual abuse, with Michelle Schiller-Baker, Executive Director of St. Martha's Hall, Susan Kidder is Executive Director of Safe Connections, and Lisa Jones is with us from the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, where she directs the Victim Service Division. Back to continue our conversation and to take more of your calls. Stay with us, those of you who are holding, and those of you who would like to get into the conversation, give us a call to 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can reach us through Twitter or through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Again, welcome back. We continue our conversation about violence against women with Lisa Jones, Susan Kidder, and Michelle Schiller-Baker. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Reach us through Facebook or Twitter. Let's go right to the phones and bring in Ted calling from Manchester. Go ahead, Ted.
Hello. You talked about some help. I'm thinking about the question of resources for families. You've given a lot of good ideas, but books and videos, other materials that people can use to put these ideas into action and share and discuss within a family. Do you have any suggestions?
Yes. As far as books, we have quite a few at the shelter that we use. There's one called Macho Paradox that we think is really good for men, and that's Macho Paradox by Jackson Katz. Mm-hmm. There's also another book that we use called The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. We use that quite a bit. The Dance of Anger by Ann Lerner, I think it is. There are a lot of really good books. You can always go to, you know, the websites and Google. You're going to find that. You can probably call Safe Connections or any one of our organizations. We'd be more than happy to mail list out to you. I don't want to, you know, it's a lot to give you over the air, but there are some really great videos and books out there that you can certainly go to and get.
And there's also a great website called Men Can Stop Rape, mm-hmm. And you can go on their website, and they have a lot of really good resources, especially for, you know, young men and boys and how to talk about men and masculinity issues. Yes. And violence against women. It's a great resource.
And another great website is A Call to Men.
Yes.
Out of Washington, D.C. Outstanding website and incredibly important information on that site.
With age-appropriate, you know, information for, yes, you know, the age of your children, for both men and women children, yes, male and female children.
But I have to wonder, how realistic is it to expect men who are in this position, even though I think it was you, Michelle, who said that it's not fun being in this position, how realistic is it to think that they're going to go out and pick up a book and read it?
Well, it's not realistic. What's realistic is somebody like the gentleman who just called, who's interested in getting that information. Mm-hmm. As I always say to my husband, like at least once a week, please talk to your people. You know, it's going to come from other men. So it just starts that ripple effect. If one man becomes educated on it and understands the root cause of it and how to intervene and do prevention, he passes that on to the next one. So we're looking at it from other men.
All right. While we're talking about men, let me just ask this question, because I know it does happen from time to time, and that is women abusing men. How often does this happen?
Well, it does happen. There's no question about that. And actually, and interestingly, Safe Connections is receiving one of our trends is receiving more and more calls from men and from young men who are coming out as victims mm-hmm. of violence. So part of that is just the increased attention that has been in the media, that, you know, Penn State, I mean, all of those kinds of things kind of have brought some of these underground issues above ground, so that there is an increase in at least the reporting of it. Can we say there's an increase of it? No. We can say there's an increase of reporting of sexual and relationship violence.
Is the pattern of the women who would be involved in this against men pretty much the same as it would be for men against women? That is, I mean, perhaps abuse themselves as children, that sort of thing? The profile similar?
Since men are just now beginning to talk about it and come out, there is not a whole lot of research on that. So we can't say that the pattern has been set. But humans are humans, so you can surmise mm-hmm. that the pattern's going to be the same, that they witnessed it, they saw it in their own home, that they've been exposed to it somehow, and they've gotten the message that this is an okay thing to do in a relationship if you want to control your relationship.
What form does that type of abuse normally take? Is it battering? Is that the same word we would use typically for women abusing men?
In that percentage of it, yes, it takes right. the same form. It's coercive. It's manipulative. It can be physical, verbal.
Financial, emotional. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
Where does psychological abuse come into all of this?
Well, the whole thing. I mean, just imagine.
Well, I mean,
it's all very psychological. It's as you referred to that Stockholm syndrome. It's very psychological. You know, you don't go out with somebody on the first date, say, "Hi, I'm an abuser, and I'm going to hit you." There's a grooming there. There's that showing the best side of that person, and then gradually you begin to use those manipulative and coercive behaviors.
But you can
psychological.
Sure, you can abuse someone without hitting them. I mean,
absolutely.
Sometimes
clearly.
That's the hardest
right.
because you'll get calls from people, or I talk to people on a regular basis. It's like, well, he's never really hit me, but do you feel fear? You can fear. Never has to have a physical part to it. A person can be violent with never being fearful. I mean, all you have to do is ask somebody who's been in a bank and the bank's been robbed. That robber does not have to hit anybody to get the money and strike fear in them.
And actually, one of the ways that we educate both men and women when we do talks is that, you know, my definition of abuse is any behavior which causes fear. Doesn't include slapping, punching, or hitting. So there is a great deal of psychological abuse, I think, that goes on just in terms of stripping this person down of their humanity and objectifying them in a way that makes them feel, for some, that I'm deserving of this abuse because I'm now buying into what this person is saying to me.
And we want to dispel the myth that women who are victims of domestic and sexual violence begin as those without self-confidence or without self-esteem. You know, the strongest of women, if frankly psychologically battered or pounded time after time after time, and someone, a woman who is the victim of this coercive control, will be that will be diminished. I mean, her esteem will be diminished, and her self-confidence will be diminished. And along with that is an increase in her fear that no one's going to believe her, that fear of not being believed. So this is where we dispel the myth that domestic and sexual violence only happens here with this type of woman or in these neighborhoods or this socioeconomic status. It doesn't matter what you drive, what you have in the bank account, where you live, how many kids you, what kind of job you work, your highest degree. None of those things matter because relationship violence, sexual violence happens to anyone, anytime, anywhere.
Mm-hmm. True. There are probably women listening to this program right now who have never been struck, but who nonetheless would qualify as abuse victims.
Yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the interesting factors is the isolation that sometimes takes place. And, you know, you fall into that trap very easily. You know, if my partner says to me, oh, honey, I just want to spend every waking minute with you because I love you so much, that's very attractive and seductive. And, oh, my gosh, he thinks I'm great. And then you start to realize that now suddenly this person doesn't want me to go see my family or doesn't want me to go out with my friends. And all of a sudden, I am now isolated from the support system that could potentially, A, see that I'm being abused. So that's part of that psychological mind game that is often played in these relationships.
What should they do? I mean, what should they do?
At what point, you mean?
Yeah, when this is happening to them, they realize this is happening. What should they do about it?
They need to tell somebody.
Yeah. Yes.
Every human being that's ever been created needs social support to resist fear. Just think about it. If you're walking down the street by yourself at night and a strange man, somebody that you don't know, begins to walk behind you and you're a woman, the first thing a woman feels is fear. It's instantaneous. She immediately goes into protection plan. Do I cross the street? Do I do that? Whatever. But if she's walking down that street with a bunch of other people, it usually doesn't happen. Social support is critical.
Yeah, speak about it. There are different places where you can call. If you are living in a violent relationship, if you have been sexually assaulted or sexually abused, first of all, speak your truth. Name it. Find the support that is certainly out there and speak about it. If it's happening and you want to make a police report, that's great. But it's more important, I think, to any of us sitting here today. I mean, we all love to see people who do criminal acts prosecuted and held accountable. But it's much more important for me as a prosecution-based advocate that men and women get the help that they need in order to stop this violence in their lives.
Let's take a moment and let folks know how they can reach you, and we'll put the information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. But Susan, I'll start with you. Very, very quickly, how can you be reached?
Safe Connections offers a 24-hour crisis helpline, and people can call us at 314-531-2003. And that's, again, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the other folks for whom we're available are those who wish to help. Perhaps a father or a friend or a coworker is concerned about someone they know and care about and want to know, how can I help and what can I do to help this person who I think might be in this violent situation? We can help them as well.
Michelle, how can folks reach you?
Well, I'm going to give Susan Kidder's number again. I don't want to bog down everybody with all kinds of numbers because she's going to focus. Her staff will make sure that whoever calls them gets to the right organization. So I would still say call 531 2003.
That's kind of what I was getting at. Yes. If there is a central number that can be called where
that's
people
it.
Can be guided through the process.
They
you
will
know,
guide
the,
them.
The agencies here in St. Louis that work with ending violence against women are a part of a network. We collaborate very closely with one another. We actually use Safe Connections 24-hour number because they do refer people to the appropriate agencies. So it is a good catch-all for all of the different programs, both for men and women, for adults and children in the St. Louis metropolitan area.
And all of our staffers are trauma-informed and experts in this area, so they provide these kind of referrals, but also assistance to those who perhaps need safety planning assistance or just, you know, other kinds of support, medical, legal, you know, whatever it might be.
I indicated in my introduction that evidence of violence has been on the decrease. There are some statistics I have here. Between 1995 and 2005, sexual violence is down 64% and has been relatively stable since. Does this ring true with you? This is from the Internet, and I'm always a little bit leery of that. And if so, what's going on?
It's interesting because I see those same statistics, and I can certainly tell you that it does not feel that way. It doesn't feel that the rates are reducing or going down at all. You know, our office is issuing as many, if not more, sexual assault and child sexual abuse cases and certainly domestic violence cases than I've ever seen in the 22 years I've been working there. So I don't know where some of these rates are going down, but I'd like to see those communities because it doesn't feel like it here in St. Louis County anyway.
Yeah, agreed. Our numbers, the need continues to outpace the resources.
But you're right, Don, in that those numbers are, I mean, we're seeing those numbers coming from the FBI statistics that we see. So they are, you know, being reported accurately.
Well, I guess in a sense that's encouraging, but if you ladies don't see it and you're right in the middle of it, that would indicate something else. I've been hearing, again, I'd like to look at my notes here, about domestic violence dockets. We've been hearing an awful lot lately about gun courts and that sort of thing. I'll start with you, Lisa. Does that make sense to you, dockets in the courts dealing just with this subject?
Well, I think it's an interesting idea that's being floated in different parts of the country. I don't know that it's a bad thing. I don't know that it's a good thing. I would prefer to see all courts address this issue on a consistent basis across the board. And what I mean by that is that the faster we can move a case through the system, the higher rate of cooperation that we get from victims. And that's across the board. You know, if I'm a victim of sexual violence and my case is going to take a year and a half, 2 years before it comes to trial. That's a long toll that a victim has to go through. So I would rather see well-educated judges, well-educated police officers on the issues of violence against women so that these cases can move through in an expedient way, still protecting the rights of defendants and their civil rights, but also protecting the rights of victims to a swift form of justice.
Susan, your thoughts about that? Do you think special courts would be a good idea?
Well, Lisa just was exquisite in her comment. And I really don't have anything to add to that. I mean, the faster the better. I mean, that these things don't linger and languish and she is not in a situation that is just potentially lethal, frankly.
I disagree a little bit. I think we do need specialized domestic violence dockets, primarily because, unlike most crimes, domestic violence has at some point been legal in our country, depending on what the states, all the states. So it's still brand new, and I think that the prosecution of it, both criminally and then on the civil part, which could be orders of protection, those things still need to be monitored to see if we're actually doing it. And it's going to be, and it's difficult to monitor those unless it's a specialized docket. Now, we do have in the county, St. Louis County has a domestic violence court, and they run the dockets, and it's on civil orders of protection. And what we are finding is that it is helping. You know, women can get in there and get this done a lot faster. And then you can monitor how well that order of protection is being enforced. So we have contempt dockets, which to me was just phenomenal that we got that. So I can't praise St. Louis County enough, especially the St. Louis County Family and Domestic Violence Council under Judge Burton, who got that done. So I'm for specialized dockets until we can prove that they're not helping.
And I should say that, you know, within a lot of prosecuting attorneys' offices, they do have specialized prosecutors that handle, for example, the sexual assault cases. We do have and this is across the St. Louis metropolitan area, there are specific prosecutors who handle domestic violence cases with the hope that they have specialized trainings to understand the dynamics that these victims go through. And there's certainly, like Michelle spoke to, on the civil side with orders of protection, setting up the domestic violence court really helped to have specific judges that are trained in the dynamics of domestic violence that certainly expedited those dockets.
Only 30 seconds left. Lisa, I'll put this to you. With regard to sentencing, is sentences tough on batterers, abusers?
No. And that's I think that across the board, there needs to be better education in the community at large, since those are the jurors that are making those decisions. But I'd like to see mandatory minimums on a lot of cases involving domestic violence, because I do think that it lags behind some of our other cases.
That's the next step then, perhaps. Thank you so much. Lisa Jones with the County Prosecutor's Office, the Victim Service Division. Thank you so much for being with us. Michelle Schiller-Baker, thank you. Of St. Martha's Hall, thank you for being with us. And Susan Kidder of Safe Connections, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Most interesting
discussion. Enjoyed it. Thank you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll check in with the Beacon's Washington correspondent, Rob Koenig, for an update on sequestration, progress in the continuing resolution, and all sorts of activity by the Missouri and Illinois delegations in Congress, including the stand span. Have you been hearing about that? We'll also talk with Jill Farmer about her new book on time management. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.